Okay, I want to do two things today, but I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to end up talking about what I want to, and that's schools and the role of schools in identity. First of all, I want to talk a little bit about the question of when, and it's a big historical debate, when people in France began thinking of themselves as French, and then I'm going to specifically look at the role of schools in that. And I guess I'm going to talk a little bit about schools today, too, because, you know, identity is something in an age of mass tourism that's a little hard to hold on to. So I think I'm going to talk about that as well at the end. I know I am because I love talking about it. And so I will be repeating just a couple things that I said the first day, but many of you were shopping other things the first day. So the problematique or the question to be resolved is, you know, did people in France, the majority of the population, or all the population, begin thinking of themselves as French as opposed to something else? And as I said, the first time that in 1789, about half the population of France spoke French. In 1871, about a quarter of the population spoke French. It's a leap of faith to think that what the language you speak totally informs your identity or who you think you are. I mean, I gave the case of Alsatians who spoke a German, who many of whom considered themselves French after Alsace and much of Lorraine were annexed to Germany in 1871. Now, there was a book published by a friend of mine who unfortunately recently died, an homme de lettres, a wonderful writer called Eugen Weber, that put forward a view that some people find convincing and which I don't find convincing at all. But it became sort of the canon or the accepted assumed truth about national identity in France, was that in his view, until about 1880, until the Republic became rooted, that you had in provincial France, and particularly in rural France, and particularly in the south of France, you had almost a total unawareness of what it was like of French identity. Somebody in about 1864, if I remember right, went into a school in the Lozère, which is France's least populated department, with only about 77,000 people now live in the Lozère, and asked them what France was. And the students in the school had absolutely no idea. And this particular book marshaled all sorts of evidence about sort of savage beliefs, as he would put it, that people believed in. It was just a superstitious, isolated rural France in which civilization, entre guillemets, in quotes, could only come through, along with national identity, through these sort of agencies of change. And this is what sociologists used to call modernization theory, almost at its worst. And I say this with considerable affection for my late friend Eugen Weber, and we had debated this before. And the three big agencies of change, some of which you've already heard a little bit about, according to Weber, that transformed peasants into Frenchmen were railroads, that is, again, the trunk lines reaching out from Paris, all railroads leading eventually to Paris. Secondly, military conscription, teaching people, Breton, or people from Gascony, or even Limousin, people from the center of France, good French, or males anyway, by forcing them to speak French. And third, schools. That is the increase in literacy in France, dramatic. In the course of the 19th century, there was always a big gap between male literacy and female literacy, and this gap is closed, such as by 1900, the vast majority of people in France can read and write. How do we know that, by the way? Well, one of the ways that historians have tried to assess those things in the past is looking at military conscription records. Or, for example, looking at the people who are witnesses to life's great ceremonies, births, marriages, deaths, whether they can sign their name or whether they just simply write an X that they can't sign. And of course, there are other ways of knowing this too, you know, studying school records and this sort of thing. So this is the basic kind of interpretation that became for many people quite compelling. As I said the other day, so by 1914, you have these Bretons, and Breton is a language that has nothing to do with French at all, being able to go off to die in 1914 or subsequent years singing the Marseillaise. Now, the role of language in the military is an interesting subject. If you take the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which had at least, depending on how you count it, 12 major national groups or nationalities, to get anywhere in the army, and the army was a kind of social promotion. To become an officer, you had to know German. In order to become a bureaucrat or to become a teacher in most parts of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, you needed to know German. And so the argument has been about France as well, that the traditional view is that the school teachers gradually, why they're sort of forcing the Virgin Mary out of the walls of off the walls of public schools, replacing her with Marianne, the female image of the Republic, are also bringing French to all of the little kids, and therefore civilizing France and turning French peasants into French men and women. Or so that is a conventional view. Well, I don't agree with that view. And what I want to do is nuance it, and then drawing on some of the research of my friend Jean-François Chanet, talk a little bit about the role of schools in the last half of the 19th century, and then talk a little bit about the roles of schools now, because I said I find it interesting. Now, the whole question of timing is essential in trying to understand when we can at least, and this may be sort of a leap of faith, assume that French national identity had permeated all of the département in France, and Corsica is a case apart that's even more complicated. So the question is timing. But again, simply to repeat what I said the very first day, if you look around the map of France, what did people speak in 1871? What did they speak in 1789? They don't always speak those same things now. In most cases, they don't. And so that suggests that the timing is crucial in all this. But just again, I did this the other day, but what the hell, let's do it again. Up here in Flanders, many spoke Flemish. If you're moving into Lorraine, amputated Lorraine and Alsace, well, most people, the vast majority, and we'll be more specific about this when we talk about the origins of World War I, spoke a German dialect that's very similar to that spoken in Freiburg. Savoie was annexed in 1860. They spoke a Savoyard language or dialect that's very much like Piedmontese in the case of Italy. I mean, language is fascinating. At the time of the unification of Italy, in the 1860s and 70s, remembering that Metternich once said that Italy was a geographic expression, the percentage of the Italian population that it spoke now what we consider to be Italian was about 5%. That is, the people spoke Tuscan, or what they speak around Florence. So if you move down here, and they spoke Provençal, which is a real, you know, written language, and had a revival with various poets, in a place called Les Baux, here, which has turned into kind of an equivalent of Euro Disney, sort of a tourist trap, like so many places in the south. Moving to Languedoc, they spoke language of Oc, they spoke Languedocien, and with all the its patois, variants, spoken language variants. In Auvergne, they spoke in Auvergnat patois. Down here, they spoke Catalan. Here, they spoke a patois influenced by Spanish. Here, they spoke Basque, which doesn't have anything to do with anything outside of a little bit of Hungarian and Finnish. Up here, they spoke Gascon. And I gave cases before of people speaking patois, and even in Normandy, and even for that matter, in the Valley of the Loire. And here, they spoke Breton. There's a wonderful book, if you want to, here's a good paper topic. Take a book called The Horse of Pride, written by a man called Elias. He wrote it in Breton. It was translated into French and then to English. And it's about growing up in the 1920s and 30s in Finistère, which is the furthest, most Breton of all the départements. And it's about what happens when, you know, the outsiders, that is the French, begin to come. And they start calling the French Kodakers because they come with Kodak cameras. And so they become the Kodakers. And so the church says, we have to stop all these crazy superstitions in Brittany, people rubbing statues to cure themselves from various ailments. I mean, the most ludicrous is probably an imaginary saint called Saint Pissou. So if you rubbed or said prayers to Saint Pissou, you probably already got it, you cured yourself of urinary tract infections. Saint Pisou. So they send in these priests who are supposed to preach in French, in Brittany. This is the 1920s. So again, the question of timing is crucial. And at one point, he tells this hilarious story where the priest, and I guess I can remember this when I was a little tiny boy, the priest would turn around and say at some point in the Mass, Kyrie eleison. I guess that means Christ has mercy. And he would turn around and all these Bretons, particularly all their Breton kids, he turned around and say, Kyrie eleison, and he was greeted with gales of laughter. Because Kyrie eleison means in Breton, purely by coincidence, there are many wagons. And then they would all laugh at him. And so there was a failure to understand each other, and the idea that somehow these Bretons were all kind of plouks, were bumpkins, were uneducated, people who could never become part of the true France because they didn't know French very well. And of course, what the Bretons do is they move to Paris in large numbers. And the first thing you see in the Gare Montparnasse is the assistance still today. It's the Office of Social Assistance for Bretons. And they all live around the Gare Montparnasse, which is why so many cafes around the Gare Montparnasse in Paris are named after Breton towns. À la ville de Saint-Brieuc, à la ville de Nantes, Dinan, and all this kind of stuff. Okay, so what about timing in all this? So, was Weber completely wrong? No, I mean, it depends on what you're talking about. If you wanted to talk about when people in the Loire began thinking of themselves as French, the answer is really in the 17th century or in the 18th century. And certainly the French Revolution, which precipitates this enormous civil war in the West, was basically a war between Jacobins, that is Paris centralizing French, and people speaking patois who resisted in the name of religion and in the name of their nobles who resisted the influence of the French state. And if you're going to take, Alsace and Lorraine were conquered by Louis XIV, who would have conquered Wyoming if he could have, and they become France French in the 17th century. So there is a shared identity there. You can have more than one identity. You have more than one identity in your lives yourselves. So it's kind of silly to look for this one national identity that emerges. If you wanted to, one of the historical facts, it's bad news for this kind of general oversimplified interpretation, is a series of events that doesn't concern you in this course. And that is the revolution of 1848. There's a big revolution in 1848. It begins as an urban revolution in Paris and in Rouen and in Limoges and Lyon and all sorts of places, becomes basically a rural movement of people on the left in much of the center, even more of the south of France. And it ends in 1851 when Louis Napoleon, the prince prince president, would become Napoleon III, when he has a coup d'etat on the 2nd of December, 1851. And people in Paris wake up with pillboxes. But what happens next? And don't write this down, but it's good to know, is that it gives rise to the largest national insurrection in France in the 19th century to defend the Republic. And most the secret societies that were formed have a lot to do with this. I once read the interrogation of a great-great-great-great-uncle of our neighbor, who was arrested for trying to defend the Republic, and his interrogation had to be translated from patois into French. And so in departments, I won't go through them all, but from the Pyrenees Orientales to the Aude to the Gare, the Hérault, the Gare, the Basse-Alpes, or now it's called the Alpes d'Haute-Provence, the Drôme, the Ardèche, and all these places, they rise up to try to defend the Republic, and the vast majority of those people that did were peasants. And many of them did not speak French. Now, political action is a form of establishing one's own national identity. They were fighting for a French Republic. One of the ironies is that people, for example, in Catalonia were fighting in Catalan, in the Catalan language, for a Jacobin view of the left, held by the left, that would view their own language as something antithetical to progress of the civilization that people thought was represented by the French language. So the question of timing here, you could argue that for this area here, which was extremely backward, though I hate that word, the Limousin, these departments here, and you don't have to know the département, but the Creuse, the Corrèze, and the Haute-Vienne, where I used to live in the Haute-Vienne, I don't have much affection for it actually, but these areas, the timing is much earlier than 1880s, and they didn't have to wait for trains, military conscription, or even to be able to know the French language vis-a-vis the school. And so there's some more things that could be said also in terms of explaining the how complicated this whole question of identity is. And that we have a tendency, people who believe in modernization and everything has to pass through modernization, you know, believe that history runs on railroad tracks and all you have to know is when the train arrives in the station. And that you forget people along the way. A friend of mine once said it's bitter hard to write the history of remainders. That's something that's always haunted me, that phrase. People who weren't modern and therefore, you know, aren't interesting and shouldn't be studied. But in fact, the roads, the increase in roads in the 18th century, the improvements in roads in the 18th and the first half of the 19th century were more important than railroads were in achieving in many parts of France this kind of integration. And furthermore, if you look at the expansion of the French economy, and again, the only what we're thinking about is timing. Don't worry about these details. Just having you think about national identity, the French economy expanded rapidly in the 1820s and 30s and 40s, and again in the 1850s and 60s, when railroads had something to do with the 50s and 60s. But it expands with the improvement of roads that bring people into towns that make them aware of La France and make them aware of politics. And what all these departments, there were 18 of them that rose up in 1851, that rural people, before, you know, as they drop their and run across the fields, dump their pitchforks and their hunting rifles as the troops come. But you know, every one of these people, you know, what they really had in common was that they were in areas in which the market had expanded in the 1820s and the 1830s through better roads. So again, I mean, railroads were important. The first railroad ride that many people took in France were pilgrimage sites to Lourdes and things like that. More about that another time. But that's not all that's important. And if you just look for what is modern, that is like the TGV or the god-awful trains going to New York, you know, from here, then you miss a lot of the action. So the timing is important. But what about, you know, 1914? Did these Bretons who were conscripted, do they really know much about France that they're going off to fight for and to die for? Well, that's a leap of faith as well. Certainly it's true that the French language spreads among Bretons through the war experience. Those people lucky enough to have survived, they weren't in the 1,500,000 dead, but that's coming during the war. It's not necessarily coming before the war at all. Furthermore, just because one didn't speak French, did that, you know, condemn people to you know, eternal backwardness? You know, I've studied strikes in Limoges in 1905 and before that, in which the workers who were striking against big companies, against Haviland, the porcelain, oh, that's another story, the Haviland American Porcelain Company, they were chanting, "Long live the Social Republic," not in French, but in Patois. But in Patois, in the Limousin Patois, not in French. Does this mean they're not French? No, it doesn't mean that at all. But it just means that you know, part of their identity is being from that particular part of France, and you can have multiple identities. And so the sort of simplistic view of when these people start seeing themselves as French, you know, is extraordinarily complicated. What about Corsica? You know, you still got about 7 or 8% of the population, that's just a guess, who don't want to be French at all. You still have people blowing up occasionally these, you know, high-rise, you know, apartments, condominiums, you know, in Corsica because they don't want tourists there in August. And, you know, to an extent, I mean, you know, I'm not for blowing up anything, but who can blame them not wanting tourists there in August? I mean, we're just blighted by tourists. You know, in the South. So, I mean, it just is terribly complicated. And of course, the case of Brittany is classic. You know, it's gradually the French language moves in this direction, But still, in the 1920s and 30s, the overwhelming percentage of the population still speak Breton in daily life. I mean, what about, just an aside, one of, you know, thousands of asides, but what, you know, what about time since World War II, before I get to schools? What do people speak, when does Patois disappear? Well, I've always been interested in that because we live in a village of about 339 people. The very old population, the church bell rings slowly, very, very often, and another of us has been snatched away, sadly. In the south, in this part of France, in the Ardèche, in what you call the Vivarais, the Bas Vivarais, doesn't matter, people spoke Patois in daily life the 1920s and 1930s. And then people who were old would speak it among themselves in the 1940s and 1950s. But people that I know that are old, including my boule partner, you know, boule, we play boule, and we drink a little Chardonnay, or I'm not supposed to say that, but we drink a little Chardonnay on the side, or pastis, quelques pastis de temps en temps, pas de temps en temps, tout le temps, mais, you know, the people that are playing, my friend who's 80, he can understand Patois, but he can't read it, and he can't write it. When I asked him to correct some sentences that I'd copied in Patois in a book that I did for the French translation, he couldn't do it. So that's disappeared. But say in Auvergne, I mean, you know, Auvergne are these departments here. I won't go through them all, but Aveyron, Cantal, Audouard, you know, et cetera, Puy-de-Dôme up here, maybe the Allier a little bit. In the 1960s and early 1970s, Patois was still spoken in many households. And when the classic kind of eternal triangle, that is the parents, the school kid, and the teacher, was often then, you know, had something to do with language, because the parents felt themselves at a disadvantage because their French wasn't as good as their Patois. This isn't the 1860s, this is the 1960s. And in Corsica, you know, there's still people who speak, you know, Corsican language, but basically almost everybody now speaks French. And even in the movie I mentioned this other day, by Jean de Florette and all of that, I mean, there they had to equip one of the main actors, Daniel Auteuil, they had to train him, even though he's from Avignon, how to speak with a real Provençal accent. But that's false, because in the 1920s, when he comes back from World War I, they're going to be speaking Provençal. They're not going to be speaking French. Now, what about? Well, I don't even have time to get into this, but about universities. One of the things that's been good in the last 20 years in France is that before, I mean, as I said, De Gaulle wanted to crush regional languages and cultures like grapes. But one of the things that's happened is that now universities are very active in teaching these languages that are part of the regional identity that is not necessarily antithetical at all to the sense of being French. I mean, University of Nantes, which is horribly right-wing, but Rennes, you know, Rennes in particular teaches Breton, and there's been a revival there, or Perpignan, very, very strong in Catalan studies, and in Toulouse, which is a very good university there, though it's the city's wonderful, but the university's a dump, and also when we had the big explosion there, in fact, we were there when that all happened in the fall of 2001, where, you know, there were some even more horrible explosions in this country, as you well know. You know, the whole campus was sort of moved by this enormous, huge explosion when this chemical factory blew up. But there's been a revival in the teaching of Occitan, you know, these sort of Languedoc languages that were soon to disappear, et cetera, et cetera. Now, so be a little cautious in assuming that, well, everybody in 1914 felt themselves French, or thinking that these sort of agencies of modernization are what created this, what we'd have to admit is a strong French a French identity. But also, one of the things, I mean, we'll see, you know, I'll probably be in tears by the end of the lecture, because I'm so afraid that these regional identities are going to disappear. and that tourism may have something to do with that as well. And that would be too bad with the end of these license plates and things like that that I mentioned before. That's not impossible. Ironically, those of you, anyone who's been to France or been anywhere, I know that the green Guide Michelin, in a way that may have even had, along with the gastronomy guides, as a way of at least making people think about regional culture, tying it closely to what is unique about a region and presenting it to tourists, and what's unique about cuisine. And some of the really famous, and now, if you want to spend 250 baldi for one person to eat in these places, $250 per person. Some of them have even so emphasized their local origins of what they're preparing that this may work against this sort of onslaught of this single French culture. And so, well, let all these flowers continue to bloom. Now, what about schools? I mean, certainly Weber, like anyone else, is right that schools make a huge difference. And the history of school houses is very interesting. Now, basically, until 1833, and I'll explain why 1833 in a minute, there are two things that could be said about the teaching of anything. Or three things. One is that girls were much less likely to go to school than boys. Second, that many school teachers were forain, which were mobile. There are people who simply would go from town to town teaching for a month or two. That villages, some are very resourceful and would start schools taking advantage of one of these people, but that the church education was primarily dominated by the Catholic Church, and education in the informal sense as well. Now, to be sure, 5% of the French population were Protestants. More about that when we get to the Dreyfus Affair. But the priest was often, in the 18th century, the only person who could read in many villages, and his reading knowledge would be basically limited to the Bible, or repeating things that he'd been trained to say. But the church and the teaching sisters, the nuns, really dominate in many parts of France, and places that were still practicing that old-time religion, dominant education. Now, in 1833, a law comes along called the Guizot Law. Guizot was a Protestant from Nîmes. He was not what the French would call rigolo. He was not a very happy-go-lucky guy that you want to have a couple beers with or a couple 7-Ups with. But he was Protestant, and so what he wanted to do was to wrest education away from the clutches of the Catholic Church, as he saw it. So through his inspiration, they pass a law that says that in every village in France, in every one of France's 36,000 communes, you had to have a school. Now, the reality was that many were so poor that they couldn't. In our particular village, and I'll have to make reference to this because I've studied it a little bit, the school moves from rented place to rented place. But 1833 matters because the school teacher now has the stamp of official authority. He is supposed to teach in French. Now, how do you know that? When I say he has a stamp of official authority, what does that mean? So I got curious as to what that means. And to see what difference he made, I did the following, which is that, as I said before, the big rites of life, birth, baptism, marriage, death, have to be witnessed. And since the French Revolution, this is kept by the state, not by the parishes. So you have to have people who witness it, who say, I see this baby, I sign on the dotted line. Now, usually what you do in a small village is you would take some notable person who knew how to read or write, perhaps your wealthy uncle or somebody's wealthy uncle, and then you'd, because the person can sign his name, and then you'd take your cousin who maybe probably couldn't sign his name but can make a pretty good X when push comes to shove. With 1833, I started looking at all these registers. Yeah, just for a day, that'll do it. But look at all the births and all the baptisms and all the all the marriages and all the deaths. And what happens is this proud signature of the school teacher. He becomes this sort of, not obligatory, but the chosen person to say, I have seen this baby. I have seen this couple. I have seen this corpse. And so, and does that tell you something? Well, French school teachers still have this wonderful signature that my kids were, you know, who write terribly, have terrible signatures, like mine, were never able to pick up. But that tells you something, because he's supposed to get a minimum salary of 200 francs, which is virtually nothing. Some people are paying him in asparaguses, depending on, or on endives, or in apples, or not paying at all. Families that were too poor were exonerated from having to pay anything. And he's just barely scraping by. But he doesn't have a red, white, and blue sash like the mayor does. But he represents the state and the authority, and above all, the prestige of the state. And he's a challenge in his very existence to this Virgin Mary being on the wall of these public schools. These are public schools. So now in 1850, this is before the course, it doesn't matter, there's a law called the Falloux Law, which you can forget as soon as I said it. And in the Falloux Law, really it's a compromise with the church, and Louis Napoleon hands back control over local committees to the church. And in parts of France in which people still practice religion, where religion still mattered in private and public life to the degree it always had been, you still have people that want to have church schools. In the north of France, you know, when you're reading Germany Now, you have to also imagine you've got these Belgian nuns with these wild, you know, hats that they used to have still teaching in the schools. You have convent people coming down that know a little literacy, not very much, and they're teaching. They're doing the best they can. The quality of the clergy in France was never higher than in the 18th century. It was pretty low in the 19th century. But still, you know, you have these competing sources to educate the young people. Now, parents often resist their kids going to school. Why would they want to do that? Well, mothers are responsible for the household economy. You have to have enough money to keep the household going. And for very many people, and not just workers and peasants, it was difficult to explain what difference in the long run it mattered if their child learned how to do more than the very minimum of learning how to read and write. So I got a hold of some statistics on truancy, for example, and that was pretty interesting to see. You know, and it's quite clear that whenever there was a harvest, a silkworm harvest in much of the southeast of France, wine harvest in Champagne or in Burgundy or in Bordeaux or Languedoc, almost anywhere, or the various harvests that begin in July usually with the grain. I mean, the kids just didn't go to school because they weren't needed there. But there's always this tension because parents said, you know, my little girl should be in CP or my little boy should be in CP, which is the equivalent of first grade, but I need her or I need him to watch the small animals. The big kids watch the big animals. That's the way it is. The big kids go on the transhumance. That is when you take the sheep up into the mountains. We still have that every year. My kids go on the tour, or at least one of them goes on the transhumance with the sheep going up in the mountains. And they would say, there's no way I'm sending my kid to school. But in France, as you'll read from Chip Sarwine's book, they put in laws, as they do in Italy, as they do in Germany, and as they do in Britain, that says, you don't have any choice. Pas de choix. You have to go to school, and you have to be there until the age of 11 or the age of 12. So the assumption is, in this kind of view of how this all works, is that these guys, these teachers, male teachers, increasingly women teachers later, but only later, it becomes a job along with, we'll talk about this some other time, along with department store clerks, and when clerks becoming more female as opposed to male, it becomes a way for peasant girls and working class girls or young women to get jobs. But the view is that these teachers, who are called instit in French, instituteur, but just teachers, these primary school teachers, virtually nobody went to lycée, goes to high school, hardly anyone goes to lycée. Until the second half of the 19th century, that these people are teaching the French language and that this is how you're going to learn it. And there's always a story told almost every place how in school, even during recess, the last person who says a word in patois has to clutch for the remainder of the period some oddly shaped rock or coin until somebody else screws up and says a word in patois. Are you kidding me? It doesn't work like that at all. And Jean-François Chenet he went out to study in the 1850s and 60s and 1870s school teachers and schools. And he begins with surveys, some of which have I read, that they ask school teachers, what do you want for yourself? What do you want for your village, for your school? And what do you want for your kids? What do you want for your kids? And they would reply. But you know, these guys, they're filling out forms that their superiors in this hierarchical, centralized society are going to look at. And if they write, you know, basically, they don't understand French. We talk about the great battles of Napoleon, but we do it in Auvergnat, you know, or in Patois, or we do it in Languedocien, or we do it in Catalan, you know, then they're going to get themselves in trouble. So you have to sort of sneak around a little bit these sources. And the more Chenet looked at these places, it's clear that regional identity is still very important. You know, the famous map of France, or the famous map of the world that had in the 1890s, after the big period of new imperialism, you have the color of France in its colonies in Senegal, or when that was Mali, or Réunion, or anywhere. But you have to begin with a region, and so they're beginning with a region. If they're from the Hérault, if they're from Montpellier, or from around Montpellier, you know, that is their frame of identity. And so it's absurd to think that they weren't actually teaching in these languages, local languages and dialects and patois, just as it's absurd to think that people who didn't master French perfectly or even very well at all didn't have some, depending on the timing, some sense of being French. So these schools are terribly important. And they could be teaching about, you know, all this stuff they had to learn about, you know, the kings of France and all this crap that they still learn over and over again. And, you know, they're teaching that stuff in patois and in dialect. And maybe in the north of France, I mean, you have to, everybody's always talking about this imaginary line from Saint-Malo to Genève here. And it's mostly in the south of France where these languages persist. And I don't mean persist in a derogatory sense, where they continue to thrive. But this bilingualism will continue. And also, I mean, a lot of the views of these sort of backward provinces are written by Parisians or by military officers, for example, who show up and they find some peasant walking down the street and they say, hey, you know, can you give me this information? And the person understands perfectly well what they want, but they identify some person coming with speaking French as a tax collector, or a military guy or something like that, and you're apt just to give that secret smile and pretend like you don't understand a damn thing, just a secret smile. And then they go back and they write, boy, these people here, they can't speak French at all. They are hopeless, they are out of date, they are plouc, they are, you know, bumpkins, and all of that. But I mean, eventually, as I said, that you have these schoolhouses that they will improve over time. They get more resources. They're made to have more resources. The towns do more and more for them. Girls' schools start up. Girls' education increases rapidly, and thus it's quite, you know, these, if you're another Zola novel, which is a great one, called Au Bonheur des Dames, which is about a department store. It's about the department store Bon Marché in Paris. I mean, for these young women, get really miserable jobs, and what they're doing is they're sleeping in dormitories under horrible sort of draconian regulations about what they can do. But for them to get those kinds of jobs, they have to be able to count, they have to be able to read, they have to be able to write. And so women's education increases dramatically during this whole time. But what does not, you know, it does not change is the prestige that the school teachers have, that they maintain as representing not only national identity but also regional possibilities, and in teaching the youth of France how to read and write. Now I thought, just because, you know, maybe you'll find it interesting, for the last 10 minutes, since I did what I basically wanted to do and held myself down and not giving countless and countless examples, is talk a little bit about now. Because one of the things that I became interested in is how, you know, if these areas in the South, particularly, that are tourist infested during the year, if they are going to remain more than simply sites for tourists from the north, from Belgium and from Germany and from the Netherlands and literally from the north of France to come and visit, schools have to maintain their traditional role in representing the identity of these communities. And those of you who are, if there are any people here from Nebraska, where my wife is from, or from Idaho, or from Oregon, where I'm from Eastern Oregon, or from Wyoming and places like that, will know the process by which schools are closing down because there are not enough kids left. France had in 1851, two-thirds of the departments in France in 1851 were larger than they were in 1939 because of two things. One, the collapsing birth rate, which I will talk about another time. In much of France, people stop having babies, point, period. Or they'll have, 2.1 babies or 1.8 babies. That's kind of hard, but statistically. And second is that what in French you call le grand départ, or the big departure starts, as people who have lost access to common resources, for example, in the mountains, or the silk industry collapse, or the wine industry collapses. More about that when I talk about phylloxera disease. Don't write that down or even try to spell it now. There's this huge withdrawal from the countryside toward more urbanized departments. And because the population has stopped growing, basically by 1900, if it wasn't for the arrival of people from Italy and other places and from Spain, the French population wouldn't even reproduce itself. It wouldn't even stay constant. In much of France, and indeed, I would argue, of 36,000 communes, let me say that perhaps in 10 or 12,000 communes after World War II, there were one-room schoolhouses. And a one-room schoolhouse, you've seen movies involving them. They have them in the United States too. In a one-room schoolhouse, you'll have all the kids of all the grades being taught by one person. Our kids were several years in a one-room schoolhouse. It's a great way to grow up. You have, in France, you have grades from first through fifth grade. They're called CP, et cetera. And the oldest kids, if he or she is remotely intelligent, will help with the younger ones. But everybody is together in the same school. And with the depopulation, what they did is they tried to have single-sex schools. You'd have a boys' school and a girls' school. But that becomes too expensive because the state is paying for all this. And the communes are paying part of it. So what they do is they say, okay, we're going to have one school. It's called in French a classe unique. And it's a wonderful way to grow up where you've got cats and you have dogs and you have, the older kids are trying to get ready for their exams, they don't have it anymore, but a brevet to show that their certificate that they have been in class through our equivalent here in America of the fifth grade. And you might have if they have a kindergarten, you might have a little boy or girl peeing in the corner, literally, while all this other stuff is going on. And, in our class, a dog gave birth during the middle of math in our class in this school. And all of the tests that people have had show that kids who come out of that environment do just as well, in fact, even a little better than people in your normal class where you've got everybody in the first grade, there they all are, and here's the second grade, and then you've got sort of elite class for those people whose parents are pushy enough to get them in that, and you've got all that stuff and some of what you've seen. But as all this is expensive, what's happened over time is that these one-room schoolhouses are closing down. And between 1975 about 1990, 10,000 one-room schoolhouses in France closed. And what this does is it causes unemployment for school teachers, but many of them, can stay on in other capacities, but it means that they're long bus rides. They're already long bus rides because many departments don't have that many high schools, and you've got to take buses in order to get to the high schools and that sort of thing. And that is sad because that's a wonderful way to grow up in these schools. And that's part of regional identity and village identity that's going to disappear. And let me give an example again from our village because it's interesting. We were faced with the fact that the school was going to be either grouped with another village, detested rival, or be shut down. So what are our kids are supposed to do? Where are they supposed to go to school? And one day we were convoked to the town hall, to the mairie, by our school teacher. And most of our parents' meetings with the school teacher ended with a bottle of Armagnac, I'm pleased to say. And we're all dear friends. Even the people that you're not dear friends with, you got along with fine. But remember what I said about the role of the school. The school represented, from the outside, France looking into the village, in principle, teaching French, providing opportunities for people to get educated and get a school, get a job in the post office or the train station or in a department store in Paris, Avignon, Toulouse, or wherever. And one day we were convoked by the mayor, and the mayor then wasn't a friend of ours, it's somebody we knew, and he had a sash on, and he said vous instead of tu. You know, he spoke to us formally, and this teacher was nervous. He said, God, he said, we have the great pleasure of having Monsieur le Maire. And we're all looking at him and saying, quoi? You know, qu'est-ce qu'il y a? You know, Monsieur le Maire is going to hear. He's going to be here to talk to us. And we're all a little nervous because our school's maybe going to close down. We'd started a semi-illegal canteen to feed the kids, lunchroom, so the parents wouldn't put their kids in the other school. At one point, we had 9 kids left in the school. We could get closed down. And we're a little nervous. And the guy says, my friends, which he's not, we're not. He said, we are gathered here together so that we can best see how we can cheat the state. And the minute he said cheat the state, we had an alliance, all of us. Because how are we going to keep a semi-illegal lunchroom going so that we can keep a couple more little kids in our school? How are we going to do that? And I realized then that the relationship had totally changed, that the school still represents France. It's a cruel system where you'll be, you know, in the fourth grade and your teachers will call your parents and say, votre fille, elle est nulle. That happened to one of my daughter's friends. Your daughter, she's nothing. She has to go off and do this menial job because she's never going to make it to the next level. There's always tension in these parents' meetings. I mean, it's a cruel system, but it was the outside looking in. It represented the possibilities of France and the French language, which we've exaggerated. And I suddenly realized that now it's very different. And that if our village, like all these other villages, are going to remain living, vivant, and more than just a Michelin-infused speck on the dot where people come along with their green guides because it's so beautiful, and this is true of all these places, they're not all equally beautiful, that our school has to survive. Because even people whose families have hated each other's guts for generations, who detest each other, all agree that since the church is now just a voluntary association like any other, like the Petanque Club, the Boule Club, or the Foot Club, I mean the soccer club, that the only thing that arguably will hold the village together is the identity that comes through this school, the school of this particular village, which is called Balazouk. So just simply in conclusion, you know, let's not exaggerate this one national identity, nor assume that modernization has come crashing along. Let us realize the complexity of national and regional identities, which can become intertwined, which are intertwined, and let us realize that these schools have a remarkable role still in these communities, terribly important at the most basic level, and that remains in France, neighborhood and village. See you on Wednesday.